I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Rabbi's guest today is Yitzhak Pincus, author of the fascinating new book, Kosher Astrology, A Jewish Guide to Celestial Wisdom.
I've always thought that for rabbis in the Middle Ages, astrology was a kind of a science with a predictive quality.
Absolutely. There was no distinction between astronomy and astrology. They were one.
We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Pesach Sameach V'Kasher, a happy holiday of Passover. This is a peculiar Passover, with the U.S. and Israel at war with Iran, gas prices surging towards startling heights, anti-Semitism prevalent again on the left and the right of the political spectrum, and a general feeling of unease in the world. The Israeli government of Bibi Netanyahu seems intent on reoccupying southern Lebanon, a policy that has failed in the past for Israel, while here in America our leadership seems less and less stable and rational, if possible. During this festival of freedom, we perhaps all have a little less to celebrate than we usually would. Still, it's very comforting to know that in even worse days than these, things can improve dramatically in short order. The best example of that in all of our history happens to occur in the climactic moment of the holiday we are celebrating this week, Passover. While we began the Pesach narrative, our people were enslaved in Egypt, and it took miraculous divine intervention to break us free. And yet, even after we received freedom, our Israelite people were pursued and about to be destroyed by Pharaoh's army. A bleak, black moment. All seemed lost. But just when destruction is imminent, God steps in and saves the day. Or was it God? The Midrash tells us the Israelites were trapped on the shore of the Sea of Reeds with the Egyptian chariot army racing up behind them. Moses boldly raised his rod, fulfilling God's pledge to part the sea, and nothing happened. Destruction riding up behind them, the Israelites trapped. It looks very bleak indeed for our people. Tension builds, disaster looms, but then a courageous man named Nachshon steps into the waters of the sea. He walks in ankle deep, then knee deep, then waist deep. Nothing happens. Nachshon wades farther in, up to his neck, and still nothing happens. Finally, in desperation, he takes the full plunge, steps into the sea until water comes up to cover his mouth and nose, threatening to drown him. And only then do the waters suddenly part, allowing all the Israelites to pass over into freedom. That message is powerful. Freedom from slavery, from fear, from depression, is a partnership between God and human beings. When we choose to serve God and act courageously, we can attain true freedom. We can pass over our own challenges and reach the shore of the promised land. Freedom may be God-given, but it is also not always guaranteed. What we must remember is that while we have a right to not be enslaved, we must choose to act to preserve and protect freedom. And that requires courage and faith. To play us in on this fourth morning of the Festival of Passover, here's a song from the end of the Pesach Seders we observed last week, Ki Lo Na'eh, sung by cantor Alberto Mizrahi, a past guest of 2 Jewish.
Oh, chi non è chi lo è. Chi lo è, lo è, chi lo è, chi lo è, lo è, chi lo è. Chi lo è, lo è, chi lo è, chi lo è, chi lo è.
That was Chazan Alberto Mizrahi, Abe Mizrahi, singing Ki Lo Na'eh from the Passover Seder, a composition of the great cantor Moshe Osher. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest this morning will be Yitzchak Pincus, author of the fascinating new book on a subject you might think was out of bounds for Orthodox Jews and perhaps all Jews. It's called Kosher Astrology. Learn what that means and what astrology may have to teach us when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people, an individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort? As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Yitzchak Pincus has written an extraordinary and gorgeous book called Kosher Astrology, A Jewish Guide to Celestial Wisdom. It takes us from how is it possible for a Jew to get into astrology and how does it all play out into some of the really profound observations in Jewish sources and the internal conflict that Jews have often felt about the whole question of astrology. Good morning and welcome to To Jewish.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
All right. So tell us a little bit about your own personal journey into astrology. You went to yeshiva and there you learned nothing positive, I would think, about astrology. Tell us how you ended up doing this.
Absolutely. Growing up, you know, the only thing that I knew about astrology is that it's something in the newspaper column that says, you know, Pisces on Tuesday, your boss is going to give you a raise, things like that. So to me, it was just ridiculous. I never took it very seriously. And then one day, you know, man plans and man laughs and God laughs. Man plans and God laughs, right? So one day I was in the car with a friend of mine who had mentioned that he knew a Jewish woman who does astrology. So I was curious. I said, okay, let's call her up. Let's ask her some questions. And we called her up. She asked me for my birth date, and I gave her my birth date information. And she started saying, wow, you have a lot of the element of ear. Are you a scholar, a professor, a rabbi, a writer? So yeah, maybe I'm not all of those things, but yes, it spoke to me. That's I love writing and reading. And my friend, she said, had a lot of the element of earth, which is much more grounded and practical. And he was a school principal, and he felt it fit him well. And that was my first encounter with astrology. So, you know, it wasn't a lot of information, but it was enough. You know, I was thinking, had she switched it, had she said I was earth, that wouldn't have fit me. And he said that my friend was ear, that wouldn't have fit him. So they gave me enough opening to look into it. So I bought a couple of books on astrology, and I discovered that there's so much more to astrology than we think. We're not just a Gemini. We're not just a Pisces. There's a lot more information. There's an entire birth chart, so it gets much more complex. And I was blown away. It gave me so much information about who I am and what I'm here to do in this world. And I was so struck by this, I started reading books and I started studying different Svarim and Jewish books. And I was shocked by how many Jewish books there are and how many great rabbis there are that speak about astrology in an incredibly positive way. And that began my journey into astrology.
It is a fascinating journey. And again, really a gorgeous book. Takes us all kinds of places into Chaldean astrology and beautiful illustrations. Anyway, we will explore astrology a great deal more and see what this supposedly superstitious study, which actually has some profound bases in Jewish tradition and in science for that matter, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established more than 7 years ago by great congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. Religious school is available for school-age kids and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, our vibrant Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Come in person Friday night. Services are at 6:30 p.m. to celebrate Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. Services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. You can also attend services on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. And all of our Adult Education Academy classes, including Torah study, are taught live and on Zoom. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, to sign up. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, at Beit Simcha, the fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, T-O-O JewishRadio.com. Streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, is a very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and Spotify. Post a rating, review 2 Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments really help.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
We welcome back the return of our randomly recurring Haikus for Jews, back for Pesach this year. Lacking fins or tail, the gefilte fish swims with great difficulty. And on Passover, we opened the door for Elijah. Now our cat is gone. That was the Passover version of our Haikus for Jews. For you, a little enlightenment.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Like a lot of people who like to travel, I like the Nordic countries, Scandinavia, many beautiful, really beautiful part of the world and interesting countries. And there has been a Jewish presence there, never huge. I do recall attending Shabbat services in Stockholm once, and the day was so long they just decided to hold them at 10 o'clock at night. It was light when you walked in, it was light when you walked out, but, you know, it was kind of a neat experience. People were still wearing top hats and tails for Shabbat services back then. This has got to be 20, 25 years ago. You've had some experience. Let's talk about the Jewish communities in Scandinavia.
Yeah, and a point of caution. Finland is not included in Scandinavia. So I think what you want to talk about is Jewish communities in the Nordic countries.
Thank you.
You specifically mentioned Finland.
Okay, so I need you to explain the geography to me, since Finland's like right next to them, but it's not Scandinavia?
Correct.
Is that an ethnic difference?
I have absolutely no idea. I do know that Danish, Norwegian, and Swedish are all mutually comprehensible. They're essentially variations of the same language. They're Germanic languages. And Finnish is a completely different language family.
That's for sure, yeah.
Finland, for a long time, was ruled by Swedes, some of whom lived there. So Finland still has these weird language laws. It is officially a bilingual country, Finnish and Swedish. And each village, when you enter it, the road sign says, welcome to such and such. If more than 50% of the population is Swedish, the first version will be in Swedish. On the other hand, if more than 50% is Finnish, the first line will be in Finnish. And this becomes hugely expensive every time in a smaller village somebody dies or somebody moves in. It can change the balance. They have to redo the signage. And it's a very sensitive point because it costs a lot of money, but it's like a sacrosanct principle of life in Finland. And at least when my friends were growing up, I don't know if this is still the case, but when people sort of our age were growing up, even if they were 100% Finnish, they had to learn Swedish in school. So they had to become, by the time they finished high school, they were bilingual in Swedish and Finnish.
All right, so let's talk about the Jewish communities in these Nordic countries. I stand corrected.
All right, well, numerically, they're all very small. And in fact, I'm not sure there is a permanent Jewish community in Iceland, which is one of these countries with a closely related language and the world's oldest parliament. But there certainly are Jewish communities in Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and Finland. And you know, all these countries pride themselves on tolerance. So there's not a big record of anti-Semitism, except in the sense that in some of these countries, Jews weren't allowed to settle until like the end of the 19th century. And that was due clearly to some form of prejudice. They're all Protestant countries by and large. And most of them are not very religious countries at all. You know, they're sort of the stereotypical view of the Nordics is dour, unsmiling. But in fact, they're relatively jolly people, and they put a big premium on harmony. And the most interesting thing that I ever experienced in terms of Nordic Jewry was once I had to address a graduate course in political science or international relations or something like that, at the northernmost university in the world, which is Tromsø in northern Norway. And this is far north of bigger places like Trondheim and hours by plane north of Oslo. So we got off the boat in Tromsø. We went to the university. Then we wandered around town, and we found a Holocaust memorial to the Jews of Tromsø who had been deported during the Shoah. And it just amazed me that so far north, where there was barely a university, there was a Jewish community. And it was big enough that a certain number were deported, and those who were left erected a monument to them.
You know, it is remarkable. I'd like to say, I mean, Jews lived on every continent of the world except Antarctica, and there have been Jewish communities of note really everywhere. Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to that.
This week's Jewish Poetry Slam comes from the latter stages of the Passover Seder last week. It's about the great prophet Elijah, who comes to every Seder. It's called Visitation by the poet Larry Kolker. It seemed as far-fetched for Elijah to visit every Seder and drink from every cup as for Santa Claus to visit all those homes and eat all those cookies. And yet, opening the door is such a steadfast gesture. A silver cup of sweet purple wine is such a heartfelt offering. I believed only a God soured on humanity could refuse to bless us. We never saw Elijah, but blessings arrived. That was Larry Kolker's charming Passover poem, Visitation. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. And this week, yet another Passover favorite. A blind man sits on a park bench. A rabbi sits down next to him, takes out his lunch, including some Passover matzah. The rabbi sees the blind man has nothing to eat, and taking pity on him, he takes a piece of matzah and gives it to the blind man. A few minutes later, the blind man turns, taps the rabbi on the shoulder, and asks, "Who wrote this garbage?" You see, the blind man thinks it's in Braille, and never mind. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and enjoy your matzah this week. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion, first after Pesach's over, is Shmini. It includes a very dramatic and traumatic event. The tabernacle in the wilderness has just been consecrated, and the priests, Moses' brother Aaron and his sons are entering into their office. The Shekhinah, God's presence, fills the tabernacle, and all is right in the world and good with the people of Israel. But then suddenly disaster strikes. Aaron's eldest sons, newly ordained priests, named Nadav and Avihu, offer what is called Esh Zarah, strange fire, to the Lord. They are immediately struck down and devoured by fire, dying before the Lord. In the aftermath of this tragic shock, Moses consoles Aaron with strange words. God says, "By those brought near to me, I am consecrated and honored before the people." There is no word in the Torah on whether Aaron accepted this as somehow a just ending for his sons. The text merely says, "Vayidom Aharon." Aaron was silent. We are not told the young priest's offense, if there was any. We are not told what the strange fire they offered was. God decrees, atonement offerings are made for whatever sin they might have committed, and the people are restored to God's favor. Calamity occurs, and we go on. We also do not know why certain tragedies take place or why terrible things sometimes happen to good people. As Ben Sirach says in the text Ecclesiasticus from the Apocrypha of the Hebrew Bible, we have been shown more than we can understand. We do know that Aaron's silence may be the only real response to profound tragedy and loss, and our comfort may come only when we silently acknowledge our own powerlessness. This may be small comfort indeed, but it is an honest appraisal of our ability to comprehend profound loss. May God keep us from tragedy, but may God also give us the strength of Aaron when we have to face it, the ability to accept the painful inadequacy of our own explanations with dignity and courage. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Yitzchak Pincus, will tell us what great Jewish scholars and rabbis believed in and studied astrology. His new book is called Kosher Astrology, and you will be amazed at some of the people that were astrologers. Find out more about the stars, and I guess the rabbinic stars as well, when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
While the air and sea war continued with Iran, in other war news, the Israel Defense Forces admitted that its goal of disarming Hezbollah in Lebanon is unrealistic. It would require the Israeli military to launch a full-scale invasion of Lebanon, which it will not do. The Israeli military also stated it was unable to fully disarm areas of southern Lebanon back in 2024, but it is making an effort to do that now. The IDF's biggest challenge in disarming Hezbollah is likely caches of self-propelled rockets spread out north of the Litani River in Lebanon. The IDF's divisions in Lebanon are expected to finish taking control of a territory 8 to 10 kilometers from the border with Israel within the next week, a move that will diminish Hezbollah's capabilities to fire anti-tank missiles into Israel and will extend warning times from missiles fired into Israel from Lebanon. IDF Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Eyal Zamir clarified that the military remains committed to the long-term objective of disarming Hezbollah. This objective encompasses a wide range of efforts that will continue over time. Zamir added that the current campaign is damaging Hezbollah and weakening it and would disarm Hezbollah, but only in the long term. Defense Minister Israel Katz emphasized that disarming Hezbollah is a top military priority. Israel's policy in Lebanon has been and remains clear. The top objective is the disarmament of Hezbollah through military and diplomatic means, regardless of Iran. We promised security for the northern communities. That is exactly what we will deliver, Katz said. Well, they haven't delivered it yet. The IDF also noted that once the current conflict with Hezbollah is over, the military will hang on to a security zone of 2 to 4 kilometers into southern Lebanon with a good number of Israeli soldiers. In other Israeli news, the Israeli Knesset passed a law last week mandating the death penalty for West Bank Palestinians convicted of carrying out deadly attacks against Israelis. the law, which was approved by the Knesset in a vote of 62-48, following nearly 12 hours of debate, marked a victory for Israel's far-right parties following a years-long push to increase penalties for Palestinians convicted of lethal, that is, murderous attacks. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu voted for the measure. Far-right Israeli Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, who has long lobbied for the measure, said, "This is a day of justice for the victims and a day of deterrence for our enemies. No more revolving door for terrorists, but a clear decision. Whoever chooses terrorism chooses death." The legislation has drawn widespread opposition from critics within Israel and beyond, including Israeli justice officials, progressive Jewish groups, and the foreign ministers of Australia, France, Germany, Italy, and the United Kingdom. And me, to be honest. Critics of this law say it effectively mandates the execution of Palestinian attackers while intentionally excluding Jewish terrorists who have been very active lately in the West Bank, attacking and even killing Palestinians there. In the highly volatile political climate that now imperils the rule of law in Israel, this issue further normalizes the invocation of state violence, said Michael Zusman, co-founder of L'Chaim, Jews Against the Death Penalty. It widens the gap between modern-day Israel and the central Jewish value of the inviolability of life. Minutes after the legislation's passage, the Association of Civil Rights in Israel announced it has filed a petition to Israel's highest court asking it to strike down the legislation, calling it discriminatory by design. The current right-wing government has sought to weaken the court's authority. This law does not actually spell out that it's meant only for Palestinians, but it mandates death by hanging as a default punishment for non-Israelis convicted in military court of deadly nationalistic killings. Only West Bank Palestinians are tried in military courts. The law includes provisions judges can opt for life imprisonment under unspecified special circumstances, but the death penalty would otherwise be mandatory. While the new law includes a separate provision allowing courts to impose the death sentence on Israeli citizens who are tried in civilian courts, it stipulates it is only intended for those who seek to negate the existence of the State of Israel, which experts say likely excludes Jewish Israelis. This law will not apply retroactively to Palestinian terrorists held by Israel for their role in the October 7, 2023 murderous attacks. They are subject to a separate bill now under consideration. Until now, the only judicial execution held by Israel was of Adolf Eichmann, architect of the Nazi Final Solution genocide of Jews back in 1962. That execution required a special act of the Knesset, since the death penalty otherwise does not exist in Israel. This is a terrible piece of legislation, frankly, and it gives fuel to those who claim falsely Israel's an apartheid state. In fact, Arabs and Jews mix freely throughout Israeli society. The West Bank is another matter, and establishing the death penalty only there creates a terrible precedent. I hope it's overturned by the Supreme Court soon and never enforced by the government. In America, meanwhile, the anti-Israel requirement to be a progressive in the Democratic Party received reinforcement last week. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, told members of the Democratic Socialists of America the night before Passover that she would oppose all U.S. aid to Israel, including for defensive weapons. The comments marked a reversal for the progressive congresswoman, who previously opposed aid that would support offensive weapons, but has backed allocations for defensive aid, such as the Iron Dome missile defense system. The Democratic Socialist of America meeting took place while Iranian cluster bombs were falling in Israel, seriously injuring a young girl, wounding at least another dozen Israelis. Israeli officials say Iran has shot over 400 ballistic missiles towards Israel in the month since the U.S. and Israel jointly launched the war against Iran. The Iron Dome and other systems intercepted 92% of them. This meeting was a forum to determine whether the Democratic Socialists of America will endorse. This meeting was a forum to determine whether the Democratic Socialists of America will endorse Ocasio-Cortez's re-election bid this fall. That re-election is an inevitability. She is an unofficial leader of the progressive movement who is running unopposed. This meeting comes as opposition to Israel becomes a litmus test among Democrats, particularly the party's progressive wing. Asked whether she would support an arms embargo on Israel, according to the reports, Ocasio-Cortez said, "I have not once ever voted to authorize funding for Israel, and I will never. The Israeli government should be able to finance their own weapons if they seek to arm themselves." A member of the Socialists then asked her to clarify, "If the moment presents itself in Congress, will you commit to voting no on any spending for arms for Israel, including defensive capabilities?" Ocasio-Cortez answered, "Yes." In the past, she's run afoul of the far-left party, including 2024, when it pulled its endorsement of her after she participated in a panel on anti-Semitism. She has also drawn criticism from the left for being willing to support Israel's defensive capabilities. I mean, you're not allowed to let Israel defend itself, right? Lest you think that this is just about Israel, note that participating in an anti-Semitism panel is apparently against the code of the progressives as well. In other words, it's okay to be anti-Semitic, not just anti-Zionist. But interestingly, you will find that nearly all so-called anti-Zionists are actually anti-Semites, saying the only people on earth not deserving of its own country are the Jews. One, if not the most, saying that the only people on earth not deserving of its own country is the Jews, one, if not the very longest existing population group on the whole planet, and the most persecuted one. But we don't deserve our own nation. Isn't that just racist anti-Semitism? And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World.
We welcome back the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Yitzchak Aharon Pincus, has written a really fascinating book called Kosher Astrology, A Jewish Guide to Celestial Wisdom. It begins with sort of resistance to astrology, I would say, in Jewish tradition, and then shows just how many great scholars were profoundly interested in astrology. I've always thought that for rabbis in the Middle Ages, certainly the time of the Zohar, Ibn Ezra, astrology was, we would think of today as astronomy, was a kind of a science with a predictive quality. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. There was no distinction between astronomy and astrology. They were one. And so that's really what it is, because you have to understand the movement of the planets. You have to know where the planets are in order to know astrology. So you need astronomy to be part of astrology.
So in the Talmud, there are a lot of positive things said about astrology, and then there are associations with Avodah Zarah, with idol worship, paganism. Explain kind of that balance.
Yes. So this is the very confusing thing about astrology from a Jewish perspective. There's a lot of mixed messages. There seems to be a number of different verses and different statements stating that it's forbidden, that it's a form of divination, that this is something that's strictly forbidden. And then there seems to be other statements, like when we say, well, Jews say, what do we say when somebody gets engaged? We say mazel tov, right? When somebody has a baby. And so there seems to be other indicators that seem to be very positive towards astrology. So it's a very confusing thing, and most people have this mixed feeling, you know, let me better to stay away from it. So the thing is, that's my one of the first third of my book, I focus on understanding the distinction between the not kosher versions of astrology and the kosher versions of astrology. You know, so because for most of history, people used to worship planets. The way they practiced astrology was strictly forbidden because it was literally idol worship. They would literally do all kinds of things to the planet Venus and create spells and do sorcery in order to please the planet Venus. And they believed then that that planet would then like harm their enemies and benefit them in some way. And this is called astral magic. It's idol worship combined with sorcery. So, of course, the Torah is firmly and strictly against it and speaks against it in the most harsh terms because it's literally idol worship and sorcery. Even the Talmud, when it referred to the different nations of those times, called them Ovdei Kochavim, worshiper of the stars.
Right, Akum, right? It's an abbreviation that's used so often, they just sometimes put Akum, right? Ovdei Kochavim u'Mazalot.
right. Literally that they worship the planets. So that is strictly forbidden. Another form of astrology that's forbidden is the deterministic form of astrology. So that's another thing that many people believe, that if you were born, let's say, with the energy of Mars, which is more of an assertive, aggressive type of energy, that they believe it was a bloodthirsty energy, you have no choice but to be a murdering bandit. So that's why the Talmud in Shabbos talks about and says, no, that if you're born with the energy of Mars, of Madim, then you can transmute that energy, you can hone it and channel it to become a butcher, to become a moel, to become a bloodletter. So these things are also associated with blood, but they're positive things. We're not tied, we're not stuck, we have free will. That's the big, you know, revelation that the Torah, the Jewish perspective on astrology is that it's not a sealed, fatalistic approach.
So there's a great deal, and you make an excellent point about it in your book, about the exact moment of one's birth. Can you explain how that's played out in astrology, as you would say, kosher astrology?
Yes. Yes, so the second half of the book is focused on understanding what is astrology, what can it do, what can it tell you, how can it change your life. So astrology is incredibly powerful because the moment that you're born, God takes all the energy of the solar system, the sun, the moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Saturn, Jupiter, Neptune, Pluto, all the different planets, all the unique configurations, and it's freeze-framed and implant it into the baby, into you as a baby. Now, you're carrying that energy of that moment of the solar system for your entire life. You're here throughout your lifetime to hone that energy, to hone your unique skill sets, and bring that out to the world. So we have an absolute mission that we're here to do. We're given certain skill sets and even some struggles that we have to first overcome. So there's a particular mission. So there's so much information that's written in this sky at the time of your birth. And that's how we create a birth chart that shows us the positioning of all the planets. And that gives us incredible amount of information about you, about your thinking. You know, each planet represents a different part of you. So the moon represents your emotions. So we can look at your emotional life. Mercury represents your communication and thinking. So we can see how you think and how your intellect is focused and the energy it is. And does it have any superpowers? Does it have any inner conflicts? All of that we can see in the birth chart. So it's incredible amounts of information.
All of this information, a fair amount of it was available to great Jewish scholars in the past. Tell us a little bit about some of the people that you highlight, the great Rabbanim, who were very into and maybe were important interpreters of astrology.
Absolutely. So this is what's really shocking, because in Yeshiva, nobody told me that the founding father of the Jewish people, Avram Avinu, Abraham, was a professional astrologer. This is the Gemara in the Talmud, where it says that Hashem blessed Avram with everything, and the Gemara asks, what's everything? That the wisdom of astrology was in the heart of Avram, that all the kings from the east and west would rush to his door to ask him astrological advice. This is Avram Avinu, the father of the Jewish people, was a professional astrologer. And not just that, there's another Talmud, another Gemara that talks about where Avram was talking to God about his chart, about astrology, but he won't have children. And God said, no, I'll move. You think because you won't have children because you have Jupiter in the east? I'll move Jupiter from the east to the west. So that's amazing right off the bat. And then we had many other great leaders, the Ibn Ezra, who's an incredible commentator, a biblical commentator. He lived in the 1100s around, and he wrote 14 books on astrology. He was a professional astrologer. In fact, he was such a great astrologer that the non-Jewish world read his books on astrology to learn astrology. And he was a professional astrologer, and he writes, and you can see throughout his commentary on the Torah, throughout the commentary, he includes all different kinds of astrological ideas and concepts. So this was something, and there's many others. You have Rav Rambachia was a professional astrologer, and you have Rav Shapsi Donilow, and you have a lot of them, Rav Yehuda Chassid, who wrote commentaries on Sefer Yetzirah. So Sefer Yetzirah is one of the core Kabbalistic sefers that is supposedly written by Avram Avinu, and all the commentaries bring out, because it talks a lot about astrology. So there's a huge resource within Judaism about astrology and professional astrologers within the great leaders and rabbis of our past.
You know, the challenge in looking at astrology is it seems to take us away from the kind of rational approach that's encouraged so typically in Talmud. But that's really only part of the story. Obviously, mysticism has always been sort of fascinated by astrology, and you can see Zohar extensively explores astrology without necessarily being critical of it. How does one differentiate between, as you say, kosher astrology and non-kosher astrology?
So first of all, there's two things, right? So there is this mystical side to astrology. It's part of the Zohar and Sefer Yetzirah, and so there is this Kabbalistic form, yes. However, there's the Meiri, who's another commentator, lived in the 1200s in France, and he writes a whole thing about astrology, and he calls it Teva. It's nature. This is the way that God designed the world, that there's nothing, you know, woo-woo about it. This is just like the sun shines on a flower and the flower blossoms, right? That's part of nature. I mean, that is a miracle if you think about it, right?
Yeah.
But it's part of nature. It's the same thing that astrology is part of nature. It's not a woo-woo thing. Once you understand what's happening, there are certain skill sets, there's certain abilities, there's certain strengths that you have, and you're here to hone them. So it's very helpful to understand that process.
In creating this book, you delve into a world that I think many people are unaware of, the Mesopotamian world of advanced, for want of a better term, predictive science that goes way back to Abraham's time and maybe before Abraham. They had academies to study all kinds of predictive things, but the stars, but other aspects of life too, that they believed could show you what the future would be. Is some of astrology based in that period?
So it's very important to understand that kosher astrology is never about predicting a specific outcome. That's called astromancy. That's the fatalistic version. And that was very commonly used, you know, at the time of the Talmud. You had the nation of Chaldeans, who were a non-Jewish nation, and they were experts in astrology, but they didn't practice the kosher version.
Well, but which, by the way, that, of course, Abraham comes out of that from Ur, right, in the middle of the Chaldees.
Right, but we practice the kosher, yes. So that's the root of the astrology, but they did the not kosher version. You know, when people ask me if astrology is kosher, I like to ask them, are animals kosher? You know, it's not a yes or no answer, right? There are some animals clearly that are not kosher and not allowed, and then there's some animals that absolutely are kosher. So it's really important to make this distinction between kosher and not kosher. And these Chaldeans told Rabbi Akiva, the famous Rabbi Akiva, that his daughter's going to die on the day of her wedding. Those were kind of fatalistic predictions. So that's not kosher, because that's not a truth. You always have free will. No, astrology can't predict a specific thing. However, it can tell you the upcoming energy, that you might have the energy, the transit of Uranus in the sky connecting with your birth chart. And Uranus is all about becoming independent and rebellious and speaking your truth. So let's say you have some ideas. Everybody has some ideas that they want to, that they, their opinions or different things, but they're afraid to share it because of cancel culture. What's my family going to think? And when this energy of Uranus comes into your life, that gives you the courage to stand up and to speak your truth. And that's part of individuation. So each of these energies come into your life to help you grow, to help build you into becoming the person that you're meant to be. So it's very helpful to understand that you might have in 3 years from now a certain energy coming in. Nobody can tell you the specifics of how that's going to play out in your life, but I can tell you the general energy of how it's meant to help you, if it's meant to inspire you, it's meant to be a time of healing. Those things come into your life. This is constantly Hashem sending us energies to help us grow and to help us fulfill our purpose.
In creating this book, obviously you did a tremendous amount of research. What did you discover that you didn't know?
So the first thing, literally, as I started delving deeper into it, literally, I kept on falling off of my chair when I discovered book after book, sefer after sefer, written that talks so much about astrology. I couldn't believe it. The Ramah, Rav Moshe Israelis, who is part of the Shulchan Aruch, who wrote our halachic way of life that we practice today. It was written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, and the Ramah writes his main commentary on it. He wrote another sefer called Torah Se'ola, and it's full of astrology. He talks about how the Beis HaMikdash was all designed, the menorah with the seven branches, against the seven planets. The Shulchan Lechem upon him, the showbread, the bread, those 12 breads, those were against the 12 constellations. He shows that it's deeply embedded in Judaism. And one after another, Rabbi Yitzchak Arama, who lived in the 1400s in Spain, he wrote a sefer called Akedas Yitzchak. Every other chapter, he talks about astrology. The Ramchal, writes that Hashem directs the world through astrology. And I was just shocked and blown away that one after another. So in my book, in the appendix, I have 70 great leaders and rabbis and sages who talk incredibly positive about astrology. And I was shocked because nobody ever told me this in yeshiva.
You know, it's extraordinary, and all the way up to Arya Kaplan, a great scholar of so many aspects of Judaism, genius really, also talking positively about astrology. It's funny, you have a listing in the back of 70 great scholars. I think you could probably get to Anan Sheikh Knesset Hagdola. You'd probably get to 120 if you kept looking. It's really extraordinary.
Oh, absolutely. I just have to stop at some point.
At some point it's enough.
The book is up to 500 pages. It has 75 pages of full-color illustrations that explain astrology. So it got too much. There was so much more to write and say, and so many more great leaders who spoke, and they say fascinating things about astrology. But I felt like that was enough to start off with.
Yeah, no, I think
pages.
It is. It's a beautiful book. By the way, I've always wondered how somehow there's 12 tribes when there's 13 tribes, really, and the 12 matching the astrological constellations somehow made more sense to me. But I want to ask, where can people go to find out more about you and to find out more about kosher astrology?
Okay, so my book, Kosher Astrology, Jewish Guide to Celestial Wisdom, it is available on Amazon. It's also available on my website, kosherastro.com. That's K-O-S-H-E-R, astro, A-S-T-R-O.com. It's one word. And I'm also available on, you can follow me on Instagram at Kosher Astro. I also have a YouTube channel at Kosher Astro. And I'm happy to answer questions. You can email me at kosherastrology@gmail.com.
Yitzchak, thank you so much for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be the very energetic and entertaining Jeff Perlman, author of Only God Can Judge Me, The Many Lies of Tupac Shakur. And come to my dad, Rabbi and Baruch Kohan's celebration. He's a many-time guest of Too Jewish. His 100th birthday celebration, A Century of Blessing, is on Sunday, April 26th at Beit Simcha at 2 p.m. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org to sign up. What do you do? All the matzah you have left over after Pesach. Past Too Jewish guest Michelle Citrin will tell us.
My friends, have a Chag Pesach Sameach, a happy rest of the holiday of Passover, a Zis and Pesach, a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Catch it like a frisbee with your friends in the park, or you could jump in the water and pretend you're a shark. You can make a matzah pick and play the guitar, and you can make a matzah license plate for your car. Use it as a code.